The conclusion we came out with, I mean, we had no, there was no smoking gun, as it were, of, yes, this is genocide. No, we didn't arrive at that conclusion, but we did find this information that showed there was a targeted campaign against Uyghur women to force birth control methods upon them and other means to reduce the population of Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, my guest is Peter Langan, a journalist with extensive experience, including almost 20 years with Bloomberg News in various roles, such as Asia Editor-at-Large and Tokyo Bureau Chief. He later worked as senior editor for the China desk at South China Morning Post in Hong Kong during the time of the 2019 democracy protests, the emergence of COVID-19, and the imposition of the national security law upon Hong Kong. Peter, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about where you're from originally, please?
Sure. I'm from the UK. I was born in Liverpool in Northern England. So I don't know if you know much about that city, but it's called, in the UK, it's called the capital of Ireland because of all the Irish immigrants, like during the various phases of the Irish diaspora, including from the famine. So my roots go back to Ireland. My grandfather was Irish. On my mother's side, they're all Scottish. So it kind of explained to me why growing up in the UK, I never felt very English. Which for whatever reason, obviously that reason. But I grew up there. I went away to sea at an early age, just to get out of the city and see the world, get out the country. In an unexpected way, it would contribute to the sort of track I took later into journalism. Because at sea, there's not much you can do in your downtime. You know, you're on board the vessel, you're out in the middle of the ocean, and well, as the stories go, you either turn to drink or you read. So I started to read an awful lot when I was at sea. And I stumbled upon Joseph Conrad and his writings, which really lit me up. And I also stumbled on a book called Last Exit to Brooklyn, which at the time was banned in the UK. But I was in New York with Doc there, and I found a copy of it in a bookstore and took it back and read it. And that also had a very profound effect on me. I don't know if you know that book, but it's very, very, very dark. And at the time when it was, as I say, it was banned in the UK because it touched on, well, it's based around a Brooklyn waterfront and violence, crime, drugs, homosexuality, but it dove into it in ways that you really hadn't heard before. So that book also had a very profound effect on what could be done through writing. The author was Hubert Selby Jr. And eventually a movie was made out of it. So that had a very profound effect on me and turned my focus away from this kind of romantic idea of traveling the world as a sailor. And coming back to the UK, I went and studied literature.
This is great. I mean, what strikes me, you mentioned Last Exit to Brooklyn, but also Joseph Conrad, classic like Heart of Darkness, which speak to this almost Nietzschean, Jungian dark and light, the what lies within the human soul. And I think staring out at the horizon on a British vessel in the middle of nowhere, it would seem like you start to ask those questions perhaps.
Yes, I mean, it wasn't so much Heart of Darkness that I read at the time. It was, I think it was Almayer's Folly and The Secret Sharer. And because of, you know, Conrad was at sea for so long, a mariner for many, many years, and that became a lot of the grist for what he wrote later. But yeah, as you point out, he very much uses the sea as a kind of a metaphor for, what's out there and, how we sort of navigate it. Yeah, there was just, particularly because I was at sea, and he touched on so much of his, in his work, of areas where he sailed, Southeast Asia, in particular, Africa, and other places. So, yeah, it did something to me anyway.
If I may ask, what sort of role work were you doing on the vessel, and what time period was this?
I worked in a galley, which is sort of a chief cook and bottle washer, as they called it at the time. It was in the 70s, very early 70s. Yeah, and I mostly served on cruise ships. So at that time, the airline industry wasn't anything like it was now. So a lot of people were still using cruise vessels to cross the Atlantic from the UK to North America. So this vessel used to go from, it docked in Liverpool. It was called the Empress of Canada. And then used to sail from Liverpool to Montreal. And then in the winter, it would dock in New York and do like 2 week trips around the Caribbean. So lots of stops. So that was also fascinating because I remember stopping in Haiti a few times, and that was, and again, that's where I think Conrad sort of came to life, because his writings about ports and places and suddenly seeing it. And Haiti at that time was still ruled by Papa Doc, or I think it was still Papa Doc or his son, but he had his own private army called the Tonton Macou, I think they were called. And I never saw a place before with such bone-breaking poverty on the streets everywhere. Just, it's kind of like, it was like images you see today of Sudan or somewhere, you know, it's just like, just a hellhole.
Well, it doesn't seem like maybe it's changed that much though. It's still quite disparate.
It's true, yeah. But the thing about the Tonton Macou is that you could always recognize them, because in all this drab poverty, they wore these kind of very almost Hawaiian-like shirts, flowery big shirts, and were swaggering down the street, you know, with big guns on their hip. So that experience really did, it was pivotal for me, just in all that time spent reading. And it just woke me up to the absolute wonders of literature and where it can take you. And so from there, I ended up studying literature and sort of ended up in Japan by a very convoluted route. I mean, the other thing that was very influential on me was I'm a child of the 60s, so to speak. So it was the whole hippie era and how that was fundamentally shifting society and how people thought and what you were expected to do. And so I, with a friend from college, went off hitchhiking throughout Europe and to North Africa and around and about. And, you know, the next big thing was the plan to go to India, which is what you did at the time. You know, that was the hippie trail. Again, Afghanistan, which is again nothing like it is today, but a lot of people used to go there. But that never happened. I met a girl, Japanese girl. We ended up coming to Japan, and that's how I convoluted. That's the, you know, short version. But I ended up here.
Yeah. When did you first come to Japan?
I think it was 1984.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd done a detour through the US before that and spent some time there traveling. Then, yeah, came to Tokyo. Unfortunately, the relationship didn't work out, so we went our separate ways. But I stayed, and then I very much am one of those cases of stumbling into journalism. I didn't have any, you know, clear mapped out goal that I want to be a journalist. The Nikkei newspaper group were looking for foreign sub-editors at the time, because they had plans to make their, you know, it's the biggest financial news organization in Japan, one of the biggest in the world. And at the time they had plans, I mean, this is also the bubble economy period in Japan. you know, the whole country is sloshing with money. And Nikkei had the idea that it wanted to establish an English language daily, financial daily for Asia, rather than, you know, at that time, it was the Financial Times, the Asian Wall Street Journal, that were these sort of masthead publications in Asia. So why are these foreign news organizations, you know, setting the agenda or the narrative about Asia? So Nikkei wanted to do its own. So they hired all these foreigners, sub-editors. But then the bubble imploded, and along with it went Nikkei's plans to, I mean, it had a, what was called the Nikkei Weekly at the time, which was a, you know, as it says, a weekly that was basically on business and financial and political stories about, primarily about Japan, but also Asia. And, you know, come full circle though, they did eventually achieve their goal because they bought the FT,
yes.
You know, so yeah. They got there eventually. But that's how I sort of, as I say, stumbled into journalism and learned the basics and the ropes of constructing news stories and, you know, how to write them, approach them, identifying holes in the coverage that you need to.
Well, can you tell me a bit about that? Because, you know, you've been in this world for a while, and you mentioned this challenge of overseas foreign newspapers setting the agenda for Asia. Back then, when you started off your career, how were you approaching, what were the ropes that you learned for what makes good journalism?
Well, this was very much a job, like a sub-editor job or a copy editor job, as it's known in US journalism, where the copy is delivered to you, and the vast majority of that copy at the time was translated from Nikkei's Japanese stories. So, because as I say, Nikkei at the time, I'm not sure now, but at the time they had four financial dailies or business dailies, so a massive, massive organization. And so the idea was to, they would translate, editors, Japanese editors would choose stories that would be translated and then we would edit them. So it was a good training in the sense that those stories were written for a Japanese domestic audience. And now the idea was to take the story and deliver it to an international audience in English. So like in any country, the domestic audience, domestic reader, has a background of understanding and knowledge and context of stories. You don't have to keep explaining it. But with these stories, we had to bring in context, you know, explanatory background and other things to help that story have the legs to meet the needs of an international audience. So that sort of training to think in that way of, you know, I might understand it because I'm living here and I got a certain content. So, but what does the international reader? So thinking of your reader, what was very important in that. And I think that's a key element of journalism. You know, this needs to inform my reader. It needs to give them the information they need, particularly in business and such like, about making decisions or strategy, things like that.
Do you think there's a difference between some of the more pragmatic economic commodities, business of the day stuff, and then political commentary?
Oh, yes. Yeah, very much so. You know, the political commentary comes with an agenda.
From you or from the politicians?
Well, from whoever's writing it, right? You know, to that point, I mean, in the newsroom at the time, it was clear that the Nikkei, you know, there was a national self-interest in building this financial English language news service, and it was to tell the story of Japan. Remember, it's still Japan at that period. You know, the whole story at the time was Japan is back. You know, it's had this phenomenal economic miracle of rebuilding itself from rubble, finding, and I think the bubble played a role in giving many Japanese people a sense of identity again, you know, after the war. And what that did psychologically was extremely difficult to come back from. But the bubble played a role, in my opinion, of giving back a certain self-confidence, because Japan was now, you know, the world's second biggest economy. And at the time, like they're doing with China today, they were predicting that Japan was going to overtake the US. And so how did I put this? I think, as I say, it really helped Japan build again a self-confidence through what its economy did and the benefits it gave to Japan's citizens. But into it, in my opinion, there creeped a certain sort of arrogance, you know, which is understandable when you think what the, I mean, it's difficult to understand what that economy was like now. But one anecdote I remember, like the sheer size of Japan's economy then, I think it was in The Economist. And the anecdote was Nomura Securities, the investment bank, at the time, its market value in Tokyo, its stock value, its valuation on the stock exchange was bigger than the entire Hong Kong stock exchange. That's one company. So you think of that now in the context of how Hong Kong rose, China rose. Japan was just, it was just beyond belief what it was doing. Yeah. But to get to the point of political commentary, that it did mix together there of a certain, as I say, I would term it a pride, but an arrogance started to creep in again of, you know, we are Japan, look what we have done. And it's understandable. I think any country would respond the same way when, if you can, as I say, try and get your head around just how big the economy was then and what Japan was doing, you know, and buying up all these iconic properties in the US and so on.
There's a couple of things here. So you mentioned, you know, on these cruise ships, the banned book, Last Exit to Brooklyn, that you were reading. So we've got this concept of censorship here. The other piece you've got here is national arrogance at the time from Japan, but now something we're seeing perhaps coming from communist China. And I think this integration of that with journalism and storytelling as well is a really interesting place to talk about your relationship with China. So, I mean, when did you first visit China?
Well, I don't remember the date, but it was when the old airport was still on the island. You know, you'd fly in through those...
in Kai Tak.
Kai Tak, yeah. Through the... navigating the tower blocks. So I don't remember the date. I was in Japan, of course, at the time, and I'd gone there just on a visit. I'd never been before. So I was struck by the vibrancy of the place.
And that's Hong Kong? Or?
Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And... but then I never went back for many years because living in Tokyo, which was such a, like I say, humongous, growing, dynamic city, I didn't feel a need on breaks or holidays to go to another big, you know, heaving city. I know, like you mentioned earlier, I was looking for the sea, you know, sea breaks and holidays and such like. But then when I worked at Bloomberg, I started visiting Hong Kong on reporting, editing trips. I had, Bloomberg had this like team system where you had a team of reporters across the region covering a topic. So I had some reporters in China and Hong Kong. So I'd go and visit on reporting trips for a week or 10 days, something like that, and did the same in Beijing and Shanghai and also Dalian, because I was covering commodities at the time, and Dalian was the the emerging commodity exchange in China.
Up north, right?
Yeah. Yes, up north.
So this would have been like, what, the 90s or 2000s?
Yeah.
Yeah. So first time, and then mainland China would have been in the 90s?
Yeah, I think so, yes. Okay. It would have been.
That's interesting. So you've got this period of time, which I think a lot of Chinese people today are quite nostalgic for, which is the opening up, that Deng Xiaoping era.
Yeah.
I mean, what was your impression? So, I mean, Hong Kong as one piece, but your impressions of the mainland when you first went, what was that?
Well, again, it was very, very dynamic. Literally everywhere you went, particularly in my experience in Beijing, was just construction sites. You know, everything was being pulled down and rebuilt. There was quite a debate going on at the time about the old neighborhoods and that housing structure. I can't remember.
Hutongs,
yeah. Yes. And wholesale destruction of those areas. And, Chinese reporters I was working with then, would explain to me how it's generating a lot of controversy. But the Communist Party was ruling the roost, so they just did what they did.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, though. You mentioned you had these reporters you're working with, you had teams over there. I mean, how did that change over the years, though, because compared to today especially?
I wasn't with Bloomberg right through the period where we saw the rise of Xi Jinping. I mean, I was for a part of it. So my reporting and editing experience during that time was very much, as you said, the Deng Xiaoping period and the opening up and the astounding growth. And again, to try and illustrate that, there was an anecdote. I think it came from Goldman Sachs at the time, where they wrote this research report and titled it "The Missing Barrels." And they were referring to oil. And as I was covering commodities, oil was a big part of the story, of course. So it wasn't really being seen clearly just how big and fast the growth of China's economy was happening. And they were sucking in humongous amounts of oil and causing these shortages elsewhere. And again, China was, it's not you don't have a free press, you don't have that freedom of information and such like. So the world's investment banks and oil traders are trying to figure out what's going on, And then Goldman Sachs finally figured it out and called it the missing barrels. And it's like China was just sucking up all of the world's oil at the time. And so the growth was just phenomenal. And that's very much what I saw. There was only one occasion on a reporting trip when we'd arranged to meet a business official, and we went to his office and he suddenly canceled. We wanted to discuss something related to commodities. I don't quite recall exactly. It may have been oil. And he was involved in that. But then when we sat down with him, he suddenly got very nervous and basically cancel the interview. So
he walked out on you,
He just said, "I'm not talking. Thank you."
Yeah.
And that was it. So that was my only real taste of, something's happened here that's weird and he's not telling. And it seemed clear to me at the time it wasn't just a commercial decision. He felt worried. He felt scared. So he wouldn't talk. But then the latter period, as Xi Jinping rose and eliminated all of his rivals and his so-called anti-corruption campaigns, there were companies that we did cover who suddenly the CEO disappeared. It was one of the big oil companies, Sinopec. I think it was Sinopec. They had different names at that time because this was before pre-listings. They were state-owned monoliths. And I think it was a Sinopec CEO. One day he showed up at the office and the secret police walked in and just marched him out, and that was it. And it was like, what? Our shock, and this was a company we were closely covering. So began to see that emerging in China. But my real sort of introduction to what was going on there was when I went to work at the South China Morning Post. And by then, of course, Xi Jinping had solidified his power, removed so many of the potential obstacles and rivals, and had cracked down across the country in so many ways. So it changed. The Deng Xiaoping sort of period sort of petered out, as it were, as he installed himself and, as I say, solidified his power.
Yeah. Well, there was a press conference you gave a couple of years ago here at the Foreign Correspondents Club of Japan, talking about your time at the South China Morning Post. And you mentioned a piece of investigative reporting that you had done while you were at the South China Morning Post on Xinjiang, and how that piece got killed by the editors. And it sort of came out in this press conference. It didn't seem to me as if that was the original intention of the press conference, but it got picked up that you had done this piece that had got spiked by the editors. Can you tell me a little bit about the background to that, please?
Sure. So I was on the desk, the China desk in Hong Kong. There were reporters in China, of course, throughout the country, and reporters in Hong Kong. And the Xinjiang story broke that there was, I mean, well, prior to that, there had been the riots in Xinjiang, and a number of people were killed in those riots, Han Chinese. So there was a crackdown. The Communist Party flew in a new leader to lead that crackdown, and he'd had his prior experience, if my memory serves me, in Tibet. So he was accustomed to that kind of a problem as they saw it. So because the Uyghur people are predominantly Muslim, the problem was characterized in China as a Muslim or Islamist terror problem. And it was then sort of identified with what the US had faced in attacks on the World Trade Centers, and then its military invasion that followed in the Middle East, that it was framed in that way, that China was facing this growing Islamist threat. So the crackdown took place, and then the news started to filter out. I mean, I forget who broke it initially, of the internment camps that had been built, and thousands of Uyghurs had been arrested and put in the internment camps. So once that broke, China went into, you know, PR mode that, you know, they're not internment camps, they're just retraining centers. We need to re-educate these people for their livelihoods and jobs and so on and so forth. But the problem wouldn't go away because the news media in the West kept talking about it. And there was a particular German analyst. He wrote a number of reports where he had a small staff of Chinese-speaking individuals. And they started digging into all kinds of local websites and information and what have you in China, in Chinese, and started pulling out this data and presented these reports that there was a clear directed campaign to suppress the Uyghur people. And he then started to use the word, it was genocidal, what was taking place. So one of the angles in that was that under the UN rules on genocide, there is a section on targeting a particular ethnic group or a group of some kind through imposing birth control policies. And by that way, the idea you reduce the population by basically curtailing births. And you do it by sterilizing women or various other means. So one of this chief editor of the South China Morning Post was getting increasingly irritated by these stories on Xinjiang by the, as he said, the Western press. And his view was the Western press don't really understand China. They just, you know, they just don't understand what's going on. So I said to him, because the Xinjiang story at the time was huge, it was everywhere, pictures of internment camps and so on, and some Uyghurs who had gotten out speaking of women, speaking of rape and, you know, people just disappearing, family members never seeing each other again, not knowing where they were. So I said to him, well, we have the reporting resources to be able to do this story ourselves. And the German analyst has cited so many of these websites and Chinese government organizations with this information. So why don't we go in and report the story ourselves and then write what we find, you know, based on your criticism of their reporting. So he agreed to it, sort of. He didn't stop me. So I had a small group of reporters I was working with, managing. And so I explained the story idea to them. And so off they went and started doing all the reporting and digging into these websites and looking particularly at health ministry websites, both national and on all these regional levels. So they spent about 3 months on this. It was an enormous amount of digging. And the conclusion we came out with, I mean, there was no smoking gun, as it were, of, yes, this is genocide. No, we didn't arrive at that conclusion, but we did find this information that showed there was a targeted campaign against Uyghur women to force birth control methods upon them and other means to reduce the population of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. So the story by this stage was eventually split up into three pieces. It was going to be a series. Because besides doing all that research into the data itself on the Uyghur people, birth control policies, health policies, things that had been said by Chinese officials, we then took the next element of the story was to go to international legal scholars, specialists in genocide, and ask them, show them the data. And they also came out with, you know, conflicting views about it. Some saying, yes, this is definitely falls under UN genocidal categories. Whereas another scholar said, no, I don't think so. So again, very mixed.
Well, it ought to be discussed, though, right? In the public's sphere.
Yeah, well, the whole point is to bring it out and to show based on the data and what people have said. And then the third part of the series was to look at China's kind of history with Xinjiang and going way back to moving battalions of troops into the region, bringing the emigration of Han Chinese into the region, which of course caused a lot of the tensions between on the ground level between Uyghurs and Han Chinese. So when I presented the story to the editor, he was just, newsrooms, you call it, the death by a thousand cuts, you know, just finding something that, oh, that's not quite right, that part, or this fact, we need to double check, and da 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 da. So we started doing all that and standing it up according to his commentary. But then we had numerous conference calls on it. And when he would raise objections to various sections of the story or questioning facts. The reporters had spent so much time digging into this, they could answer them. They had it all at their fingertips with every point. And basically, I think it became increasingly embarrassing for him to go on these calls with the reporters showing him that.
He was trying to slow it down, but you got to get the answers.
Yeah, it was like that process of 1,000, cuts. You just.
And you had already done these three pieces?
It was all done and ready to go.
Okay. So this got you thinking, because just coming back to this genocide question, which, as you say, there wasn't necessarily a smoking gun, but you were putting this data out there, and it sounds like doing really important work, taking stuff that was maybe in Chinese, maybe it was hard to find. You were sort of bringing it together for the public to consume, to provide an outlook. But you did mention in this press conference you did the role of IUDs and these birth control devices that are placed in the uterus of a woman. And can you tell me a little bit, there was something quite pernicious about this this technology and sort of the way maybe doctors are required to remove it. Is that a correct understanding? Or?
Not quite. It was that you think of it in the context of China itself and its one-child policy, which was slowly lifted and then finally removed. So across China, it seemed from the data we could find, IUDs, intrauterine devices, were the prime or one of the prime means for birth control. So as China lifted its birth control restrictions and the one-child policy and so on, the sales of IUDs across China fell off a cliff. And that data was there from the health ministry, and you could see that right across China, sales of these devices, uses of these devices collapsed, I think is an appropriate word. But there was one region where it didn't happen, and that was Xinjiang. So it seems that, and again, finding the smoking gun, as it were, of a direct sort of order to impose these birth control policies on Uyghur women, it's clouded as to where that came from. It filters through. It's a policy that is, but the data showed that while right across China that the use of IUDs was slumping, in Xinjiang it was actually growing.
I see.
So it pointed in to, well, what does that mean?
Well, what's also interesting here is this piece of investigative journalism could have perhaps prompted the next person to come along, or maybe there's some internal people with some whistleblowers, maybe there more information, if it had been published, would have been forthcoming to expand upon it. And this is obviously what journalism does, is it starts pulling on the thread, right? But in the end, the piece, Death by 1,000 Cuts, it never made it into the South China Morning Post.
Right.
And has anyone else tried to pick this up that you know of? Anyone else gone and investigated this?
Well, various, like I mentioned again, this German analyst, Zenz. His name is Zenz.
Yeah.
And Zenz makes it very clear in his work and the policy groups he works for, he's an anti-communist. He's very clear about that, but he does his data research. So it was out there, this information. We just did our particular piece of the puzzle in trying to pull it together in, this format of looking at it from these three different angles in the series. And, because the South China Morning Post has intellectual copyright on that, we were all working for them when, it's never been published. In fact, when I spoke about it at the press conference you mentioned, I'd never said anything publicly about it before. But because I was asked to talk there with Michael about what did we experience, first of all, Michael, of course, was in the mainland.
So this is Michael Smith, Australian journalist.
Yeah. and I was in Hong Kong when the national security law was imposed. We were talking generally about what we saw and what happened, you know, personal sort of anecdotes. But the when I was in the middle of it, then I just think, well, I should really say what happened to this story as an example of how a newspaper in Hong Kong would not deal with this issue. I mean, to this day, the executive managing editor argues that the story wasn't ready. That's why he, you know, didn't publish it. It didn't meet our standards, I think, was what he said to the media that followed up with them as to why didn't you publish. But like I said, we were ready on, we had...
You've got, you know, decades of experience. Did you think it was ready?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was definitely ready. But it was uncomfortable.
And it was interesting because you had this press conference again. This was you yourself and Michael Smith talking about reporting from on China, from within Hong Kong, from within China. And yet I understand that almost immediately you received a letter from the South China Morning Post about their comments. Is that correct?
Well, what happened is when the press conference was done, obviously it went up on the FCCJ's website, the press club's website. So there's a little independent news organization in Hong Kong called the Hong Kong Free Press. Very small, but they're doing their work. And I think someone in Hong Kong told them about this press conference and what was said about this story. So they called the South China Morning Post and asked them about it.
Did Hong Kong Free Press talk to you first? Or?
Yes, okay. They did. They wanted to verify, you know, what I'd said. I explained to them again the structure of the story, the work that was done, and so on. I showed them a copy of the story, but only under the agreement that they could not share it with anyone else, again, because of the copyright issues. You basically got a gag order on you.
It seems like copyright, though, in a case like this, there is fair use for showing it to somebody, maybe not for publishing it, right? I mean, copyright seems to sit further down the list of priorities.
Yeah, I couldn't publicly publish it.
Of course, yeah.
But for the purpose of a journalism organization wishing to verify the things I'd said, I showed it to them. But then Hong Kong Free Press mentioned in their story that they had seen a copy of the story and so on, and verified certain aspects of it. So then the South China Morning Post or their lawyers sent me a letter warning that I would, you know, would be sued, or they, you know, they're planning to sue me.
Did they sue you?
No. And then the letter they sent me, planning to sue me, I sent that to the Hong Kong, Hong Kong Free Press too. So then they published that. And so that further irritated the South China Morning Post. So they sent me another letter warning again that I faced prosecution for...
Maybe extradition.
Yeah, well, I do have still friends in Hong Kong who said to me, it's probably better not to come back to Hong Kong.
Yeah. We love you, but please don't come back.
Yeah,
That's interesting. And I mean, just talking a little bit about the South China Morning Post. So they are in this interesting space where they are owned by Alibaba, which is a major Chinese corporation. I mean, how would you describe their position? Do they have access within China that maybe other media wouldn't be able to get?
Yes, they do. They're a long-standing publication and well-respected. And they have reporters throughout China. When COVID broke, for example, the South China Morning Post sent in, I think it was four reporters into Wuhan within a day or so of the news breaking. I'm not sure if you remember how it happened, but there was a group of doctors with a WeChat closed group, and they were saying about all these odd pneumonia cases they were getting coming into the hospitals across Wuhan. And they were sharing it amongst themselves and sharing information as doctors. But then that leaked from that closed group. And it then got onto WeChat and went viral, as we say. But the story was SARS is back. It's broken out again in Wuhan. And then the local authorities were forced to put out a statement confirming that there'd been unusual cases, a large number of cases of what was termed unusual cases of pneumonia across the city. And so South China Morning Post sent 3-4 reporters straight into Wuhan. Literally, I think it was within 48 hours of that official announcement going out. And they wandered all over the city. They went to the market. They'd already shut it down, the market where the story was the virus had emerged from an animal in the market. They went to hospitals. They, you know, interviewed people.
So there was some good journalism taking place here.
Oh, absolutely. A journalist organization, for whatever reasons, takes these kind of positions, whether pressure from the government or owners or whatever. You know, the journalists on the ground, you're still dealing with people. I mean, there's great journalists at the South China Morning Post. The people I worked with were wonderful. I mean, they were fairly young, but really enthusiastic and committed. They've all gone on. I mean, the group I worked with on that particular story all quit after it. It was not published, but they've all gone on to, you know, work at Bloomberg, Reuters, other places.
Well, that's quite telling, though, that they were principled enough to resign when faced with this journalistic integrity question of why didn't this get published?
Yeah.
And, I mean, you left as well, right?
Yeah.
Not long after.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was, if that story and the refusal to publish it may have just been a tipping point for some people, because we'd already had, there's one particular incident where when Apple Daily was shut down and Jimmy Lai was arrested and the owner, and there were images across Hong Kong on TV and what have you of armed police marching into the Apple Daily newsroom, arresting journalists, confiscating computers and so on. And some of those journalists are still in detention today. So the staff of the South China Morning Post demanded a conference call with the leadership, just what does this mean?
And this is Apple Daily. This was one of the largest daily newspapers in Hong Kong, quite openly critical of the Communist Party.
Oh, yeah.
And a very wide readership, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very well-known paper. And again, yes, as you say, Jimmy Lai is a staunch believer in a free press, freedom of association, you know, democratic political systems and so on. And he made it clear through his newspaper. Anyway, there was a conference call to South China Morning Post after this, because the obvious question is, are we next?
Yeah.
You know, I'm a foreign journalist here. Have I written something that through the national security law, they'll now find a way of bringing me in for questioning? And, you know, what does all that mean? So very, very concerned people on that call. Particularly, there were journalists there who were New Zealanders, Australians, etc., but of Chinese ethnicity. And we know from the behavior of the Communist Party in China before that if they decide to go after you in China, even though you've got an Australian passport, it doesn't matter. You know, they'll see you as Chinese and therefore they have the authority to do what they like. So those other people of that, in that situation, were obviously very concerned. So, and some of these people have been writing about the mainland.
Well, and these are also very valuable people because often they will be speaking Chinese or Cantonese. They have maybe a little bit more of a cultural insight. The example that comes to mind, which you mentioned in this press, Michael Smith, sorry, mentioned in this press conference a few years ago, was the Australian Chinese journalist Cheng Lai, who she was jailed for 4 years. She's only just gotten out this year over some charges of espionage. And she's managed to get out. She's got back. She had two little kids. So she managed to get back to Australia. But it was basically a text message, I think, was the crux of it, and not much substance to it at all yet. Holed up in prison for 4 years because of that. And effectively, she is an Australian citizen, and they were able to do that.
Yeah.
So I can understand the risk there to being put in prison over something like that.
Yeah. Well, there's another a similar case. Similar in the journalist detained is a journalist I worked with in Hong Kong at the South China Morning Post called Minnie Chan. And Minnie covered the aerospace industry and defense issues and so on. And as you can imagine, that's kind of an area that strays into
national defense,
military, whatever. So after I'd left the South China Morning Post, Minnie went to one of the main conferences in China on defense issues and so on, which she'd covered before. And when the event finished, Minnie never came back. So this was that's 2 years ago this month. She never came back. So friends of hers on social media started asking, has anyone seen Minnie? And asking her family and such like. And no one seemed to know. So then people put two and two together and that she's been arrested somewhere. She's disappeared in China. The South China Morning Post, when it was asked about this, because the media then got a hold of it, one of your reporters has disappeared in China. You sent her there to cover this conference. What happened? And they came out with a statement. I mean, I haven't seen it myself, but what I've read of it is that it's a personal family matter. And Minnie's family in Hong Kong have asked that we respect their privacy. You know, so clearly she's been detained for some reason. There's a journalist I know who thinks that what may have happened is because Minnie had sources in aerospace defense and what have you, Xi Jinping was running a whole various bunch of crackdowns on the military. You know, there's all kinds of leading military officials, right, who've been removed for corruption or whatever is the, you know, usually it's corruption. So one view is that one of her sources may have been somebody linked to one of these individuals. And as they were brought down in their own cabal, she may have been identified as someone who's been, you know, they've been leaking information to her or something. This is pure speculation. No one knows, but she disappeared 2 years ago. And, you know, that's what they do.
Well, this is interesting because I guess, again, zooming out, looking at this question of the media, the role of the media, and then obviously what's happening with China, it seems like a lot of people are certainly around me, you know, beginning to think, especially as the United States seems to be having its own issues. Oh, well, you know, look at the way China's doing things. They get things done. They can build a bridge. They can build a high-speed train. That, you know, there's this kind of enamorment with China. And what's often not talked about is, of course, these things that we've just mentioned. You know, there's no freedom of the press. You really have to self-censor. You have to be very careful. People can disappear. And that has an incredible chilling effect.
Absolutely.
I'm really interested, Peter, in sort of at a high level, though, how do we begin to interpret this? Because there is, as we saw maybe with Japan in the 1980s, there is a huge amount of arrogance around the economy. I mean, China's making stuff that the world can't make. And so they see themselves, in a sense, as the factory of the world. I mean, how would you relate that, maybe, especially given your experience here in Japan in the 80s, that sort of hubris?
Yeah, well, if I could just go back to the earlier question, I don't think I finished the thought on after Jimmy Lai was, Apple Daily was shut down and we had the conference call in the South China Morning Post. And so the staff were obviously very concerned, as I mentioned, particularly those of Chinese origin. So the executive editor started the call by saying, I've never liked the Apple Daily. And the Apple Daily was just a, you know, ragtag kind of publication. I mean, it's true, the Apple Daily used to do a lot of celebrity gossip, scandal stuff, you know, sells newspapers.
Tabloid, yeah.
Yeah. But he spent the first part of the call all about how the Apple Daily was a reprehensible publication and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which stunned me when people are concerned about their, you know, their not only their livelihood, but their personal freedom and their family, their children, and so on. So he clearly wasn't ready to address those concerns or deal with them. And then people asked a couple of questions along the lines of, well, what would the South China Morning Post do, et cetera. And it was, they basically waffled around it. And it was a very revealing conference call. I eventually asked the editor-in-chief, you know the custom in China when the officials, when the government or whoever is upset with you for whatever reason, the foreign ministry in particular will, in mainland China, will call in somebody for what is euphemistically called a cup of tea, right? Where they're given in some form, like it's the, you know, the steel hand in the velvet glove kind of talk about, however, anyway, that you're given some kind of guidance that the government's not happy about this or whatever. So I asked the editor-in-chief, have you been called in for a cup of tea, you know, since the national security laws been imposed? And she maintained no, you know, that no, that hasn't happened. And in fact, she said many of, because again, there was an influx of Chinese officials because they were taking back control. And she said these officials had often been wanting to talk because they wanted to understand Hong Kong, as she put it. And
are you saying that these officials came into Hong Kong, into South China Morning Post offices?
No. They're in Hong Kong itself, as the national security law was imposed, there was a huge influx of Chinese officials coming in.
I see.
Because they had the central government, the mainland government, had a very big office anyway in Hong Kong, you know, where they were guiding things.
Yeah.
So there was just more and more of these people came in. And of course, this was also still during the time of the protests and, you know, COVID came later. So it was just a very odd commentary to be making when a publication has been shut down, editors, journalists, writers have been arrested, they're in detention, no one knows what's going to happen to them. And your first comment is, I never liked the Apple Daily. You know, it's just weird, very weird. There was no sort of sense of solidarity.
It's
with
quite cold, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was very much just cut the whole thing off, you know. Effectively, I don't care was the tone of it. It was just weird.
Yeah.
So that was one of the factors, again, where I spoke about for myself and the reporters I worked with, maybe that story was a tipping point, the refusal to publish it on Xinjiang. But there was lots of other signs with people were leaving, journalists were just quietly quitting. A lot of people left Hong Kong, of course. So,
well, this reminds me of an analogy that you've mentioned to me before around the anaconda and the chandelier.
Yes.
Which is an idea from a book by an American scholar, Perry Link. And if I may read a piece here, the Communist Party's censorial authority in recent times has resembled not so much a man-eating tiger or fire-snorting dragon as a giant anaconda coiled in an overhead chandelier. Normally, the great snake doesn't move. It doesn't have to. It feels no need to be clear about its prohibitions. Its constant silent message is, you yourself decide. After which, more often than not, everyone in its shadow makes his or her large and small adjustments all quite naturally.
Mm. And that is particularly true in a newsroom, because I experienced it myself that you start to, the anaconda works because you start to self-censor yourself. You know, you begin to think, well, that story, you're thinking of a story, something that's happened, or you want to follow up on something, you just know, well, that's not going to fly. They won't touch this one. So you then are sort of thinking, well, is there a way that I can re-angle this story or repackage it in some way? But then the anaconda's just hissing, you know, and you're retracting. Well, yeah, don't do that story.
Well, it's interesting as well because you don't know how far you can push things.
Mm.
And, you know, I've even thought about myself, you know, some of the conversations I've had, some of the people I've met, you know, at what point do you step over the line? And the fact is, you don't know where the line is or if anyone even cares. And in a sense, you then start to just self-censor depending on how vulnerable you may be. And it's a really messy gray zone.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe when you're reporting on things a little bit more practical, again, the business side, you know, what's happening in the markets, there's maybe a degree of freedom there. We still see some kind of more business press operating in China. But any kinds of questions of the political side, which often does have a connection back to business.
Sure.
Becomes very dangerous. And so you almost don't even know what's going on anymore. And so you have this, there's almost like two Chinas, the one that's actually out and that's happening, and then the way it's been reported about, which doesn't lead to any clarity for anybody, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it works. Yeah. Self-censorship takes place. That's what they achieve. They just need to do one apple daily, very visual, public, armed police, journalists, you in the van, gone. You under arrest, gone. And then that's it. It retreats to its chandelier as the...
Well, again, it's the classic panopticon concept as well. You don't know if you're being watched or not.
Yeah.
You know, the WeChat messages, you never know, really. Has it gone through or has it been picked up and I'm in a database now?
Mm.
I guess people by default are going to assume, yes, I'm being watched.
Mm.
And so they're going to change their actions accordingly, just as if they're under that chandelier with the snake hanging over them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's authoritarian governments, not necessarily communists, function the same way, right? I mean, I spent a number of years in Singapore, and you know, which was basically run by the Lee Kuan Yew family for, you know, since independence. And when I first got there, I took a bunch of reporters out for drinks, and we sat down at the table, and there was about 10 people there, local reporters, and an editor. And so I said, well, it was like a wine bar place, and so ordered some drinks and a glass of wine. We went around the table, and it was sort of orange juice, Coca-Cola, mineral water, Coca-Cola, orange juice, you know, which I thought, this is kind of not what you normally see with a bunch of journalists. You know, people typically drink. Nothing wrong with it, but it just struck me. Everyone's on soft drinks. And then the atmosphere got very sort of stiff and awkward. You know, those when you're in a group setting and it's just very, something's very awkward in the air. No one is talking, or someone tries to make conversation and it just dies. and this deafening silence comes back. It was like that. And so I tried to sort of shake things up. I said to everyone, can you tell me what's it like growing up in a semi-fascist state? Yeah. I mean, I was just being, you know, annoying to try and get someone to
provoke, yeah.
Say something, like tell me, I don't know what I'm talking about, I'm stupid or whatever, but to get something going. Because I was at a table with a bunch of journalists and it went down like a lead balloon. And it just boom, and like stunned silence. And then just one by one, I had a sip of wine. I'm sorry, I have to go. And everyone just left. And I thought, well, that was a bit not really a success that evening in team building.
Yeah, icebreaker.
So I asked a Singaporean journalist, a more experienced journalist. I told her about what happened. She was a very good journalist, this person. Again, it's not to decry Singaporean journalists. I'm talking about what a system can do in terms of how people relate and think and communicate. And she told me right off, she laughed when I told her what I said. She thought it was hilarious. But she said, you're in a public setting. And so Singaporeans in public settings won't get vocal of criticism of the government because, and she looked at me, they don't know who is listening, who's at that table, who's at that table. So they just decided the appropriate thing here was to leave because we've got this nutcase who's just flown in and he's criticizing the government already, you know, so making fun or whatever. And so that kind of also is an example of how it functions.
Well, totalitarian states, they can't do humor.
Right, yeah.
Fundamentally.
Yeah. In my early days in Singapore, I made some Monty Python reference to a couple of Singaporean journalists. And I said, oh, that's just like Monty Python, isn't it? And they looked at me like blank, no idea what Monty Python is because it's never been allowed to be broadcast in Hong Kong, in Singapore. So I was told. So there's all kinds of cultural disconnects like that. You just, because they're, you know, the point about humor, I mean, Monty Python sent up everybody, right? They just took the piss out of whoever they thought for the point of let's laugh at it and see what's there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are the two sort of critical roles, journalism and in comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I was just going to say before, again, Australian-Chinese journalist Cheng Lai, jailed for 4 years over charges of espionage, she said that the communist part of China is insecure. Mm. It needs to crush dissent. It needs to crush those voices that start asking questions, even if it is quite a ridiculous situation that it is. You know, maybe someone just said something, made a comment on social media, and the police are on their way.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that's going to have a chilling effect. And I mean, I'm not sure what the situation is, but certainly I don't imagine there's comedy taking place that's critical of the Chinese state within China in the way we see in somewhere like the US or the UK. Maybe arguably increasingly less in the UK, but it's sort of what happens when you can't have those conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that with comedy because that's, well, as you point out, that it's also been attacked now, particularly in the sort of, you know, the woke phenomena, that comedians, you know, challenging the status quo or making fun of it, and the woke, which, in my opinion, is originates out of Marxist-Leninist thought, basically. Everyone's either an oppressor or oppressed, you know, it's just they've switched the narrative from the economic model of the worker oppressed by the capitalist class to everything is oppressor or oppressed. You know, it's a classic Marxist dialectic, right?
It's a mind virus.
Yeah.
You know, because there's no place to resolve that. You can't ever
Yeah.
Well, without obviously killing everybody in the concentration camps, but, you know, that there's no equilibrium, there's no liberal framework through which you can resolve that dispute.
And you know, comedians just cut right through it, right? They just, and that's why they got all those people we saw canceled. I mean, and to the point though, the recent moment, Jimmy Kimmel is on the other side of that fence, right? If you got the left with wokeness associated with left and extreme left kind of thinking, but it can go the other way too. So just, yeah, it just struck me when you said that, just how important comedy is, you know, to social society. And because we need to, you know, poke fun at ourselves.
Well, it's civil society, right? And this is, again, what is under attack in Hong Kong, under siege. Not only these bookstores and these associations and book clubs and these kind of grandma and grandpa kind of organizations actually deciding to dissolve, you know, various book clubs and things. And then I imagine comedy, things like this as well, kind of fit into these organs of a functioning civil society, being able to have a laugh. And I mean, I even think back to my own country of New Zealand, you know, regularly politicians are made fun of. You know, it's kind of an ongoing game.
That's what they're there for.
You know, that's sort of... whether it's caricatures or commentary on TV, you know, it's like that's part of the deal. Mm. And when you can't do that, you have an inflation of the ego and this kind of emergence of an emperor like Xi Jinping, untouchable. And if you do dispute him, you know, there goes your head.
Yeah, even to, you know, the caricatures of him as Winnie the Pooh, you know, which is banned everywhere in China. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Our censors will take it. Any images of Winnie the Pooh.
So what I'm curious about.
Pulling up sheets of white blank paper, you know.
With the Shanghai COVID protests, right?
Yeah.
Well, what I'm curious, Peter, just I mean, trying to bring this together, though. This, you know, and certainly your career, you encountered these challenges, especially with this Xinjiang piece. I mean, where to from here? Because, as you say, though, there's still journalists doing good work in these organisations, yet. In a lot of cases, there's capture of the organization itself. I mean, where do we go from here with the media?
Well, I think where we're going is where we're going, in that even, you know, the work like what you're doing and so many others in YouTube and this diversified media, I mean, the internet came along and broke the model, right? The monolithic model of these news organizations. So I think that is where it's going, because now there's so many more voices and opinions and, you know, settings where instead of you're struggling with, you know, a 5-second soundbite, whatever, people sit down and really discuss things. So some of the most interesting stuff I've, you know, read, seen as in the recent years, it has been on YouTube, like where topics are really taken to task and pulled apart and looked at. And you need to sit down and listen to it rather than this, you know, it's like TV news now. I just can't watch it.
Well, there's also a kind of hive mind where quite talented people, you know, because a couple of people working on this Xinjiang piece, that's also possible, just a couple of friends working together on a piece as like freelance, not even freelance, just hobbyists are able to like pinpoint things pretty quickly. The internet can do some pretty amazing stuff like that.
Mm.
You know, you get some people with a bit of free time on their hands and they can track things down, you know. So it seems like there's some possibilities there with independent media.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, I mean, we are seeing maybe people's attention spans. You know, we talked at the beginning about tailoring your writing for your audience and making it consumable for an audience. Yet, what does that mean when you have an audience who can't even read, if we're honest, who can't watch anything more than 5 seconds? You know, how do you make something that talks to that person?
You mean because of the use of just scrolling on screens now? Yeah. I don't know, maybe it has to become more visual in a way.
Maybe more funny, a bit of comedy perhaps.
Yeah, more comedy. Yeah. I don't know. There's so much that I think every generation goes through this of, I remember growing up and, you know, TV. I was old enough to remember black and white TVs and then advertisings and people sitting around watching TV and then horrified social commentators saying, you know, this is the death of conversation, you know. These TV things are evil. Our brains are melting before them. And, you know, which to a certain extent, yeah, there was a truth in that, but still it was a medium. And again, it's how you use it. So it just, I don't know, the train just keeps rolling. I don't know where it's going or what the answer is to this, or if there is needs to be one. But clearly there's, okay, having said that, the thing that does concern me is a lack of understanding of history, I think. And again, going back to story writing, context, and knowing where your civilization, as it were, has come from. And you have the doomsayers, like, as I mentioned there, the social critics at the time saying TV would be the death of everything. Well, was it? Don't think so. There's good stuff. It serves a very valuable purpose when it's used in constructive forms. I mean, by the literary, art, culture, fact-based, even, you know, informing us about our history. Because the lack of the sense of history of where we've come from and what your civilization is built upon. We take so much for granted, right? Freedom of speech, you know, which it's just, yeah, it's like the air. It's here. We grew up with it. It's the way things are, right? Well, no, it isn't. You know, it was murderous wars, hundreds of, you know, millions and millions of people lost their lives in wars fighting to establish these kinds of norms, like the overthrow of aristocracies, just looking at Europe, you know, the Hundred Years' War, the 30 Years' War, and then First World War, Second World War, not only in that history breaking the control of aristocracies and kings and queens and what have you, but breaking the control of the Catholic Church. And it's just unbelievable to think what people did to achieve that.
Yeah, well, this liberal project, I mean, it's an incredible development over thousands of years to get to a point where we have a mechanism of liberal democracy through which disputes can be resolved, conversations can be had, and there's like a self-reflection possible as well. And when you start talking about censorship and you start talking about hate speech or free speech and these ideas, you start regressing to the point where you can get to a place where actually the punishment outweighs the benefit, and so people shut up and you lose all of those benefits and you go down a couple of notches back towards something like what we see with communist China, where you can lose it all for saying the wrong thing. And that's just not a very nice pathway for a civilization to take long term, you know?
Yeah.
And it always comes back
to
get you. You can't run away from
it. So that sense of where we have come from and what we've achieved, it's like, you know, the writer Douglas Murray, as he's written books on, you know, the strange death of Europe, and I've listened to him a lot in dialogues where he touches a lot on this kind of thing of the how Europe, for example, got to where it is. Yes, there are very serious black stains on that history, but out of it has also come these forms of liberal democracy, if you like, the flowering of the arts at different periods and music. And it, you know, it's astounding, that side of things. So I found his arguments and writings very compelling to look at that, rather than just trying to, you know, throwing the baby out with the dishwater because of colonialism.
Yeah.
You know, it's he makes very, very persuasive arguments to on that front. So I think, yeah, the lack of an understanding of the context of our history and how we got to where we are is something that
concerns me. The way I would wrap all of that up is nuance is important. And this is something we've inherited in New Zealand from the English tradition, the ability to take a couple of different angles and look at things with nuance, consideration, and to not necessarily go for the black and the white, because that's always the totalitarian way, is you're in or you're out, you're good or you're bad, you're oppressed or you're oppressor.
Yeah.
My final question for you, Peter, before we wrap up, what's next for you, man? What are you working on? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I keep telling myself to stop talking about this, but I'm writing a book, or trying to, and it's proving very, very difficult. There's a well-known journalist who's a member here, Robert Whiting, who you know, who's written a lot about Japan. And Bob told me a story of an American author who compared doing fiction as opposed to you know, fact-based nonfiction writing. And I think he said it was John Updike, I'm not sure, but he compared nonfiction to sort of sailing a boat and following a coastline where you can see the lighthouse and the harbors and everything there, and you're kind of, there's a sense of security. And then he said, but writing fiction is kind of like going way, way, way offshore, out of sight of land and everything else, and the weather, the monsters that lurk. and it's a totally different animal. So I'm struggling with that, but I'm trying to write a book of fiction that incorporates all kinds of stuff.
Well, you know what's out there, though, because you spent all that time on those cruise boats. So.
Yeah, I may have been partly informed by that. I'm not sure, but I mean, one of my favorite writers is Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and the way he constructed whole generations of families and his sort of magic realism, which completely captured me in reading his works, particularly the Love in a Time of Cholera was the one I've reread many times. And so that's also, I think, influenced my concepts of writing.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm working on.
That sounds great. A little bit, perhaps a little bit of James Joyce in there as well, from the Irish tradition, no?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, anyways, Peter, I appreciate your time and for sharing a story. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.